We'll get started. This is our second time working on what I call the rambunctious literature of Kierkegaard. The stuff in the last, basically the last 5 years of his life, 1850, 1855. It's not a comprehensive presentation of his thought. His thought is far more diverse and complicated than we're going to be representing it here. But these late writings are often overlooked. They don't pay attention to them. They don't believe they're representative of anything significant about Kierkegaard, and they dwell on the earlier writings, or the philosophical writings, or the writings in literary analysis, or some such thing. But I'd like to dwell on these rambunctious ones, probably because I'm kind of like that. So I find a kindred spirit. But I also think there's something for the integrity of the scholarship that he needs to be communicated these thoughts that occurred in the late years of his life, last 5 years of his life. So what we're going to be doing tonight is starting out on the text, Judge for Yourself. I'm going to identify six texts that have to do with what I see to be a spiritual corrective that Kierkegaard is interested in. We're going to be looking at four different correctives in these rambunctious writings: a spiritual corrective, a moral corrective, a epistemological corrective, something about the way we perceive events and things in our lives, and then an ontological corrective or statement. It's hard to find the right terms there, but a statement about what's fundamentally important or real in this world. And we're dwelling this time and next two times on what I'm calling the spiritual corrective. And I want to identify about six passages in Judge for Yourself, and we'll probably maybe look at three of them tonight if we're lucky, and then three of them tomorrow. And then the following day we're going to look at for self-examination, which would be the conclusion of the spiritual corrective. So that's kind of what I'm seeing that we want to do tonight. I have also two passages out of the journals that we'll look at. As soon as this stuff gets passed around, I'll start these so we don't get them mixed up. But the two numbers, the two journal entry numbers that we'll be looking at, the key one is 6323, written in 1849, and that's the one on decentralizing sympathy. And the other one that I'm adding to it is 4942. That's not listed, but maybe we can share somehow. Every other person take one so we can have the text in front of us. Before we get started, I just want to identify myself. My name is Ron Marshall. I'm a Lutheran pastor in Seattle, Washington. So this is the first time looking at the book Judge for Yourself, 1851. So he died in 1855. His writing career really got going strong in the early 40s, maybe 42, 43, the publication of the first book. The journal had been going for 10 years, which later he did revise and intend to have it published. So these were not random thoughts. These were careful statements about what he thought was important. So this is towards the end, 1851. And these are the passages that I would suggest that we take a look at. Page 118 to 120, page 133, page 145, page 153, 171, and 208. You ever have a chance, maybe you won't have a chance while you're here, to read Judge for Yourself, but if you ever do get a hold of the book, I feel fairly good that those are representative passages. If you go to those passages and dwell on those six, I think you will get a large amount of the book. Okay? Undoubtedly you'll find other things in there that will be of interest to you, but I think a large part of the book resides in those passages. I want to start looking at the passage on 118. Remember, Kierkegaard really believed that his words, the words should be read aloud. It's kind of an arrogant thing to say about your own work. But the idea was to, he thought it had a way, if you read them out loud, it had a way of getting past some superficial, I think he finally believed, superficial initial complaints about what he's saying. If you read it out loud, you get past some of those. I'm not sure about that, but since we all don't have the book, we're going to have to, in the middle of page 118, oh, abominable mendacity, oh, scurvy slander against all the heroes of the faith and the martyrs and the witnesses for the truth and the patterns, but thus it always is with us. What we wish to be exempted from is danger and effort and everything that flesh and blood objects to. Now it is true that Christianity is gentle. It may, in the form of an admission, mark well, in the form of an admission, spare the individual from much when he humbly confesses how it stands with him. It may also spare him from making the venture proper to Christianity when he humbly confesses how it stands with him. But the worldliness in us verily will not let itself be satisfied with this. It is never satisfied until it has contrived to get the wrong, the ungodly, made secure as an article of faith, as a duty, as a dogma, as true Christianity, in order that we may renounce true Christianity as ungodliness. So it is with this worldly talk in Christendom about tempting God. Oh my God, do thou make it fast, that as Christianity abominates whoring, I'm skipping over to page 119, as Christianity abominates whoring, murder, thieving, and everything else that can defile a man, it recognizes still another sort of defilement, namely paltry shrewdness, effeminate common sense, and shabby servitude to probability. And probability, which Christianly understood, is perhaps the most dangerous defilement. Yes, truly Christianity abominates and regards as defilement what the world extols and regards as the highest thing, to behave always shrewdly. And Christianity abominates this defilement as when it first entered into the world, it abominated idolatry. But this deification of shrewdness in our time is precisely the idolatry of our times, Christianity's abomination. Not as though Christianity had any objection to shrewdness regarded as talent, as a gift. No, far from it. Neither does Christianity ignore how difficult it is when one is shrewd to have to refrain from acting shrewdly. Oh, it is difficult to perceive with a shrewd eye what the shrewdest thing is and the desirableness of being shrewd, and then to have to refrain from acting shrewdly. This, however, Christ requires. For Christianly speaking, this would be the eulogy pronounced if there was a man of whom it could be said that he was the most sensible man of his times, the shrewdest man in the kingdom. It was known to all that if, in a difficult and complicated case, one sought the shrewdest counsel, he never went in vain. If he went to him, he went in vain only if he went to another man. But as for acting himself shrewdly, no, he never did it. With a purity like that of a virgin woman, like the modesty of a blushing youth, he abhorred acting shrewdly. His life was on the further side of probability. There it was he lived. There it was he breathed. There it was he ventured in reliance upon God, he of all men, the most sensible. And this is Christianity. Kierkegaard tries to identify what is an essential element in the nurture of the Spirit, in the acquiring of the mind of Christ among us. An essential element in that for him is a life of danger. And he tries to identify what that life of danger is by contrasting it with what it's not. before Kierkegaard Spinoza said all meaning comes through its negation. Omnes determinatio et negatio. All meaning comes through negation. So he contrasts it to try to get what that danger is. And it's to live a life not based on probabilities. Well, I don't know about you, but that's very foreign to me. I live my life based on probabilities. Kierkegaard says that if you do that uncritically, it saps the strength of the spirit right out of you. For there has to be an essential element of danger in your life, in your witness to the truth that's revealed in Christ. That danger has to be there or the witness evaporates. And about the only clue he gives us at this point is be suspicious of all probabilities. I am a parish pastor. That operation for me is filled with all kinds of power maneuvers. There are 1,000 people in our congregation. We don't all see things the same way. And I'm playing probabilities every moment of my work there. And so to hear this word about pursuing a life of danger and kind of letting all care go to the wind. I know it wouldn't be a wise thing politically to do in the congregation on a certain issue, because the probabilities show me that that's not the way to behave. You're probably not going to get what you think should be the policy for the community. If you go that way, it may even be dangerous. They may quit paying my salary. They may hold a special congregational meeting and ask me to go fast. But you're driven to do it anyway because of the witness. You throw probabilities away. There, I don't know, maybe it's because I've grown up in a modern society where the scientific method is something that you acquire through the basic educational system, that calculating your life on the basis of probabilities is a wise thing, a prudent thing to do. Kierkegaard is very, very suspicious of it. Very suspicious of it. The passage we looked at yesterday about the pastors, what kind of pastors do we need? People who break up the crowd. Who attack the herd instinct. Who work to nurture qualitative individuals that you can't predict what they're going to do. Because you've taken them off the tranquilizers. And they wake up. And you don't know what they're going to do. How they're going to live out their witness to Jesus Christ. That's what he's looking for. And that's why he's against a life based on probabilities and is calling for this life of danger. Now, what is the warrant for that? The one thing is kind of an abstract notion that it constitutes the life of the Spirit. But there's a historical reference that he appeals to here at the very beginning on page 118. And that he appeals to the martyrs. He appeals to those who have pursued a life of danger and have died for the faith, witnessing to the truth. And he finds the life based on probability to be a life that is utterly foreign to the witness of the early martyrs and apostles and witnesses to the truth. So he appeals to that heritage, kind of the pre-Constantinian church. He appeals to that. And it might be appropriate to say at this point, before we look at the next passage or talk a little bit about this one a little more, is I think it would be possible, and it would be maybe even legitimate to say, Kierkegaard, that in these last years, what he is really pushing is what he called contemporaneity with Christ. Contemporaneity with Christ. That he is trying to collapse 2,000 years of history and bring you right up face to face with that stinking 5'10" first century Jew who is known as Jesus of Nazareth, and listen to what he has to say to you. Now that is, to do that, you throw out quite a bit. I remember one of my teachers at the seminary saying, Kierkegaard is of utterly no use because he has no sense of history. See, I mean, if he's trying to get the individual face to face with Jesus of Nazareth, the one who was confessed as the Christ, and listen to him and follow him, you are ignoring all kinds of cultural changes that have taken place. It's like we had a stewardship drive in our church, and we decided to do a whole thing on tithing. We were talking about 10%, giving away 10% of what you have. And this one person in the church said, she said, I wonder if one-tenth meant the same back then that it means now. A lot of things have changed. Maybe numbers have changed. One-tenth doesn't mean what it did then, what it does. What it does now doesn't mean what it did then. A lot of things have changed. So to try to maneuver that way is, in one sense, the height of foolishness. It's kind of silly. Because you are overlooking legitimate concerns about selection and interpretation, hermeneutical problems, the historical changes and developments. And yet that's what he's working on. For he thinks that if you do that, a life of danger will ensue. And he is, I think the reason why there is that danger is because of that view of being contemporaneous with Jesus. Okay. All right. So that's the first element that he's trying to develop here on page 118 to 120, the life of danger. It's something that I think by nature steer away from. Any reaction to that? These are kind of accumulative passages. We could look at the next one on being genuine. This is an important aspect too. He feels there's a lot of fakery in the life of the Spirit, and that only suffocates it. If the life of the Spirit is going to flourish, then there has to be an attack on fakery. Let's take a look at that passage. 133. Second paragraph there in 133. In everyone there is a talent, understanding. And every man, the most knowing and the most limited, is in his knowing far ahead of what he is in his life. Everyone, there is a talent, and it's understanding. And everyone, the most knowing and the most limited, is in his knowing far ahead of what he is in his own life, or of what his life expresses. This disproportion, however, we men are less concerned about. Upon knowing, on the other hand, we lay great store, and all strive, each one for himself, to develop his understanding more and more. But, says the sensible man, the thing one must be careful about is the direction of one knowing takes. In case my knowing turns inward toward myself, in case I am not careful to prevent this, then my knowing becomes highly intoxicating. It is the way to become completely drunk. For then there comes about a drunken confusion between knowing and the knower, so that the knower himself will come to resemble, will actually be the thing known, and this is drunkenness. That's what the sensible person says. Skip over to 134, the first full paragraph. Christianity, on the contrary, says that just the fact that one's knowing turns against oneself inwardly, that just this is what makes one sober. That only that man is quite sober, whose understanding, whose knowing is action. That therefore it is not all necessary to expend so much effort upon developing one's understanding, if only care be taken to ensure that it gets an inward direction, that it is its craftiness to direct all one's attention and to concentrate all one's powers upon developing one's understanding that a man with only a slender understanding, but with this turned inward and so translated into action, is sober. And that a man with the greatest understanding, but turned in the opposite direction, is completely drunk. Here we are. I don't know as much as Caspar Weinberger knows about nuclear weapons. But I'm hysterical about the deployment of nuclear weapons. And Caspar Weinberger, hearing my hysteria, would say, well, calm down. If you knew what I know, you would realize that things are much, much safer than you imagine. And that you have the nuclear weapons that are deployed to thank for the safety and the comfort that you enjoy. In that conversation, Caspar Weinberger is sober. And Ron Marshall is hysterical. He's scared pissless. Kierkegaard says it's the other way around. Caspar Weinberger is drunk. And Marshall is as sober as a judge. The definition for drunkenness and sobriety is turned around. The sober one is not the one who is preoccupied with getting the argument straight and the evidence all lined up and the convincing argument expressed. The sober one is the one who sees the danger. So he's doing, he's flipping the standard and evaluation, and he's risking equivocating. He does it all the time. And that's one of the reasons it's hard to follow Kierkegaard, because he plays on equivocations. He takes the standard understanding and turns it on its head and tries to make hay while the sun shines. And so you can get lost in the argument, but that's what he's trying to do. He said only then will genuineness arrive. Remember last time we talked about a lark, when it tries to fart like an elephant, it'll blow up, kaboom. So too, the academic theologian, who ends up thinking that the explication of the faith in terms of systematic categories is more important than the faith lived, ends up blowing up because it misses the status of the academic explication. It's always a secondary consideration. It's not the primary consideration. So to hear the preoccupation of trying to understand everything. We're doing a study in our church on the material from Lutheran Concern. Some of you know about that, this group. It's been around Lutheran Church since 1974, talking about the gay lesbian issue. And wanting to talk about in our congregation whether or not we could get to the point where we sign a statement of welcome for our parish to the community in which we live. That some of you know that material, and sign the statement of welcome. Well, we needed to study the material. We needed to try to come to a proper understanding of what it's like to be a gay person, what it's like to be a lesbian, and how that fits in with the Christian understanding, the witness of Jesus Christ. And we studied it. And we studied it. And we tabled it. And we studied it some more. And we tabled it. And the rationale all the way through was kind of a Jack Webb analysis of committee work. Let's get the facts, just the facts, get all the facts. And what it looks like is that can go on indefinitely. Now, in a place that isn't known for its candor, that would be called a filibuster. Kierkegaard is worried about the pursuit of clear understanding, not because he's opposed to it. You will discover that quickly about him, that he is not an irrationalist. Those who have accused him of that have not read it carefully, I don't believe. But he's worried about the pursuit of clear understanding going unchecked or going unconnected with other concerns, running free. And when that happens in the Christian life, it wreaks havoc. It not only wreaks havoc by way of social issues, but it wreaks havoc by way of studying Scripture. Well, what did the text mean? Well, let's get to work on it. And down you go into a sump hole. You can spend all of eternity working on what the text meant and never let it hit you between the eyes. You can analyze the historical context. You can do word studies. You can do grammatical analyses. You can go on and on and on. And in my New Testament class, the seminary, I had 16 steps that I could work on. And any one of those, you could go on forever. It's not making fun of that careful analysis, but is making fun, is ridiculing it when it becomes all-consuming. And I know, I can tell you for myself, that when you do that, initially it can be intoxicating, and you can end up never getting out of that morass. Kierkegaard has a passage for self-examination, which we'll look at later in the week, where he directs himself to that specific question of studying Scripture and the importance of an erudite understanding, but when it has to be cut off. So I see it within the internal life of faith. I see it working in the polity of the church, and I see it in social issues. And I see it as something that's not obvious. I don't think it's obvious that you have to break off sometime and make a stand. Because there's always another study to read and analyze. There's always another argument to look at. So it has to be broken off. And you finally have to act in your best judgment. Now, I know why I don't want to do that. The reason I don't want to do that is because I then become exposed. I can't ever say, why have you taken that position? Haven't you read Hillary Putnam? That's why I have that position. The argument is there in Hillary Putnam. No, I have to say, I think it's right. And then I get the heat. Much rather have the whole thing laid out and I can refer to all the studies, analyses, and the respectable understandings. And then in the conversation, the disagreement is blunted or it's deflected from me. And Kierkegaard sees us hiding and he's trying to get us out in the open. Okay. 135, first full paragraph, continuing this. For entirely sober, according to Christianity's opinion, is not only he whose knowing is acting, so it ought to be. Thy understanding must at once become action, at once. Alas, it is not thus with us men. Four lines down. If the action does not follow at once, this translation into action of the thing understood becomes distorted. It becomes distorted. Alas, so it is with our actions. How much do they resemble our understanding? Perhaps like the musical note Perhaps like the musical notes thou dost reproduce with the violin bow. Perhaps like the faithful reprint of a picture. No. No, not like that. Like blotting paper compared with a script on which it is lain. Our actions so resemble our understanding. Categories of sobriety and drunkenness as connected with understanding and action are a preoccupation for Kierkegaard in understanding what nurtures the spiritual life, what brings the mind of Christ among us. A willingness finally to give up the Jack Webb theory of analysis. Just the facts. Collect all the facts. Let's collect the facts. Not that that is bad in and of itself, but when it runs rampant unchecked, it blunts the life of the Spirit. This element, like most of them, again, I don't think is self-evident. Now, a third one we'll look at is what he calls salability. A willingness to give up salability in the Christian faith. The bottom 145. People have wanted to perform the astonishing trick of saying Christianity is an objective doctrine. It makes no difference how it is served. The doctrine is the whole thing. To say that there is an identifiable content to the faith that can be read off the pages of a textbook. He calls that a trick. People want to perform that trick. This is what has abolished Christianity. It is easy to understand. There is an existential determinant of Christianity, which is the unconditional condition, without which Christianity cannot be applied. This is what it is, this existential determinant, to die unto the world. Between God, who requires thou shalt die unto the world, and me, the single individual, the poor man who is to take a bite of the sour apple and die unto the world, there is introduced as the intermediate term in the way of preaching a living, a fat and good living for a man with a family, a fat and good living for a man with a family, and a rank equivalent to that of a counselor, and the prospect of advancement. This is an impossibility. The preaching contradicts itself. Preacher stands there, you must die to the world. Thank you. Drive off in my BMW. You must die to the world. And he says at the bottom of the page, this they notice themselves. So Christianity becomes mild. Or rather, they whose career it was to preach Christianity found it necessary out of love for men, not to say self-love, to make Christianity a sellable article. So it became merely consolation, Christianity, a family who's living in the enjoyment of all possible pleasures. Then a man announces himself as a preacher of Christianity and says, have you no use for the gentle consolation of eternity, which without praising my own wares too highly, I venture to call one of life's greatest comforts and pleasures, which serves to mitigate sorrows and to give joys their proper zest. It costs $50. Why? That's a fair price. But to sell Christianity thus, without laying any obligations upon life, is peddling indulgences. It is trafficking with Christianity. And here again we are at a standstill, dying from the world, is the first and the last word of Christianity strictly understood. This was expressed also by those who in the first age of Christianity preached Christianity. They were departed souls. Now the turning point has been reached. The preaching of Christianity, or the preaching that Christianity requires thee to die from the world, is exactly the opposite of dying from the world. This simply doesn't go. To make it go, there must be first an admission that this preaching of Christianity, which in a worldly way is the preacher's livelihood and career, the admission that this is not really Christianity, however truly one may preach the doctrine, the sound doctrine. And the trouble is, in my judgment, because I'm only an unauthoritative poet, the trouble is that no one for a long while past has made the admission that this whole thing of 1,000 preachers is not really Christianity, but a softened form, made a whole quality softer as compared with genuine Christianity. It is far from my meaning to say that for this cause such preaching is entirely without profit. But it is quite another thing to say that Christianity, in order to maintain its majesty and be able to assume command, must require the admission that it is not properly Christianity. This also, to want also the infinite, or to want also the finite, to want to have one's mouth full of flour, and also to want to blow, is not merely also, but purely and simply, or solely and only, bosh. The protestation is that it is the infinite one desires, while one takes the finite. Doesn't do any good. It does not conceal the fact that there is a knowingness in the preacher and in the congregation. And if it is there, it is indecent not to attest to it publicly by an essential change, either by letting go of the finite and finite advantages, or by making the admission that this preaching is, after all, not really Christianity. It is like bashfulness. In the case of a very small child, bashfulness is one thing. As soon as it is assumed that the child is old enough to be knowing, bashfulness is another thing. After a knowledge has come about, and so after it can be assumed that there is knowledge in both parties, and a mutual knowledge that there is this knowledge, after this has come to pass, to wish to conserve the first bashfulness would not only not be bashfulness, but an extremely depraved and depraving immorality. The preaching of Christianity or its preachers have long enough, both pecuniarily and with respect to honors, titles, and dignities, lived off the fact that there have been those who sacrificed everything for Christianity. It was fine for them, but I pass. This is no longer convincing to a knowing congregation. Speaking frankly, one cannot blame them for it. How could a contradiction be capable of convincing? The contradiction of hearing a man prove the truth of Christianity by the fact that there have been those who sacrificed everything for Christianity, and of seeing that the preacher lives off of this by the aid of it in possession of earthly goods of various sorts, which in fact is a contradiction of the proof. The dangerous situation is when there is knowledge in the preacher and knowledge in the congregation and mutual knowledge of this knowledge, than not to be willing to come out with it in speech, to wish to preserve a loftier and more solemn tone, the untruthfulness of which one is secretly conscious of. This is the dangerous, the demoralizing thing. If the appeal is to the sellability of the faith, if the appeal is there, rather than to the witness to the dangers of the truth that the beginning and the ending of the Christian faith is dying to the world. Like Bonhoeffer, when he said, when Christ calls you to be a Christian, he says, come and die. If the preoccupation was the sellability of it, that beginning and end, that first and last word is eliminated. Because you're not going to increase church membership by asking people to come and die. The Lutheran Standard, my favorite magazine, had an article a couple times back talking about which churches are growing, and said it's the love churches that are growing. Do you remember seeing that? The churches that are bringing the word of consolation, not the ones that are saying come and die. Kierkegaard says that if that's the preoccupation, the spirit withers. If a friend my age says, I'm sick and tired of being a preacher. Can't take it anymore. At it. Well, what's wrong? He said, well, I'm sick and tired of trying to convince people to do what they don't want to do. Just don't want to do it. I said, what's that? Worship, study, serve, and give their money away. I spent all my time trying to convince them that they should worship, study, serve, and give their money away, and they don't want to do it. And I'm just sick of it. I'm not going to do it anymore. Why? If that's accurate. It's accurate about me. I don't want to do any of those four things either. I don't want to give my money away. I don't want to serve. I don't want to study. I don't want to worship. I want to be entertained. If that's the preoccupation in the life of Christ, in the community of the baptized, then the spirit withers. It cannot be sustained. cannot be sustained. Okay, those are the three that I wanted to look at tonight here. We'll look at the others tomorrow. But maybe now we can look at the little section on sympathy. It fits with this, doesn't it? The sellability theme. The entry 6323. Humanly speaking, is it not cruel? Humanly speaking, almost shocking to forbid him something that is a matter of piety. We do not say that Christ, after all, was high and mighty, and therefore there must not be any meddling in sympathy. That is a misunderstanding, for Christ was not high and mighty, but he was love. And the greater his love, the less his cruelty, which have been so. Oh, but not so. Christ is the absolute, and this cruelty is inseparable from the absolute. The point is that the religious person unconditionally shall and must have sympathy for all the weak. He wants to be with them, comfort them, and all that, but he does not dare do it. That is, he does not dare center his life in this sympathy, so that instead of remaining true to God, he scales down and remains in the religiosity of sympathy. Look at that. Kierkegaard is driving a wedge between the love of God and human sympathy that we normally do not see. We normally see that when you love God, you exhibit human sympathy. For Kierkegaard, the two are not identical. There is a connection. Sympathy is not ruled out, but it is not the center of one's allegiance to God as witnessed in Christ Jesus. And if it's not the center, then there is a place for the opposite of sympathy, which is cruelty. Saying the word of truth, even if it's known it's going to hurt. At one point in self-examination, I mentioned this yesterday, a person is tired and wants rest. Just can't take it anymore. What do I say to him? Kierkegaard says. I say to him, you haven't suffered enough. And then he says, who would be so cruel to say that? And he says, not I, but the New Testament would be. If sympathy is not at the center, if allegiance to God is, and allegiance to God is not identical with human sympathy, then there is a place for that which is not sympathy in the Christian life. And that is the word of cruelty. We've been hearing talk here the last couple days about the hard sayings of Jesus. And they have a cruel edge to them. But if it is true that the light came into the darkness, and we preferred the darkness to the light, if that's true, John 3, if that's true, then a cruel word needs to be spoken to those of us that have preferred the darkness to the light. Another follow-up on this is the added one, entry 4942. Here's where he says, if you go this route, you are going to be sacrificing security, which is one of the last things any of us want to sacrifice. Security, indolence or laziness, dearth of spirit, want to be sure before they venture, want to have it all understood before they act, want to be sure before they venture. And this is why secure, indolent, and spiritually impoverished pastors villainously play the yes man and supply proofs and proofs and positive assurances. These villains who have murdered millions spiritually with their false Christianity have caused the abortion of possibilities, as one speaks of inducing abortions, possibilities of becoming spirit, possibilities which were in every single one of these countless billions whom the clergy murdered by playing the yes man and giving them proofs. Christianity wants the opposite of what indolence and the sensate wants. It wants to rouse up. And that rousing up comes through offense. And Kierkegaard believed that if there is no offense to what the faith says and exemplifies in its adherence, then there is no invigoration left. Well, that's the beginning of some texts on looking at the spiritual corrective that Kierkegaard thought was indispensable. And we're starting to get a bit of the flavor of the severity of his understanding. Tomorrow when we continue this, I want to supplement it with 6 passages from the journal on joy. Because I think that's one of the weak undersides of Kierkegaard. How is he going to understand the robust sense of joy and buoyancy that comes from being a witness to Christ Jesus in the midst of all this severity? And he does think he can manage that. I think it's important to see that expression in him. But we're, I think, starting on the way to look at some of those texts that represent for him what is indispensable. Okay. Yes, Bob? You've turned into what he was critiquing.
Yeah.
I haven't thought of those passages in that connection before, but at first blush that seems to illustrate it to me. But I say unto you, the only authority that's appealed to is himself. Now when we look at fear and trembling, and when Abraham goes and does or attempts to do what God has called him to do, Kierkegaard has a very peculiar passage in there. He says, on what authority does he do that? He says he does it on the basis of his obedience to God and to himself, which are the same. So we might say, Jesus could say, but I say unto you, the authority rests with him, but we possibly can't. We just can't do that. When we're going to talk about Jesus, then we have to appeal to a text. We can't say, and this is the way it is, because we don't have that authority. Kierkegaard, I think, finally stands on the basis of the story of Genesis 22, that you have to have that kind of authority. You have to be willing to speak like that. So the more I think about it, the more it seems that it is an illustration. There's a Kierkegaard professor at University of Washington, Paul Dietrichson, who's working on a book on fear and trembling, and he and I have talked about this, and he sees my understanding of this material just to be absolutely harebrained and completely missing Kierkegaard. Because he said, how would you disassociate yourself from the likes of Jim Jones? This fanaticism, all this authority in this individual, and he tells these parents to kill their children. I mean, we know the story, right? He said, instead, what's going on in this material is an attack on fanaticism. It's a holding up of this picture and really ridiculing it. And I guess finally what I have to say is that I cannot definitively disassociate this view from fanaticism. All I can say is that it isn't it. It's not fanaticism. But I can't definitively show it. I can say that this view is nurtured in images of death and resurrection, nurtured in the call of Christ in the New Testament. Say that's where it's nurtured. It's not nurtured in self-indulgent power plays. But if you say to me, how are self-indulgent power plays different from being nurtured in these images of dying and rising to new life? I just say they're different. They're not the same. But I can't delineate it. Don't think I can, or maybe it can't be. So there is that, I think, that appeal to taking the heat. Instead of you all, but I say to you. Tomorrow then we'll look at the three other passages in Judge for Yourself and one other handout on the importance of disgust and then the thing on joy. So we'll try to do those three things and have those for you tomorrow. Thank you again for your patience and being willing to engage these issues. Look forward to working on these tomorrow sometime.